for this last stretch in the sessions of this year's conference of ARSC. I think we have a very interesting and multifaceted afternoon's presentation for you. The first speaker, Alan G. Debus, is the Morris Fishbein Professor of the History of Science and Medicine at the University of Chicago. A collector of American and English popular and historical recordings for about 50 years, Alan Debus has given presentations to ARSC in the past. In addition to many books and papers on the history of 16th, 17th century science, he has written numerous articles for record journals, including a monthly column for Hobbies magazine from 1954 to 1965. Is co-author of the Complete Entertainment Discography with Brian Rust, published in 1973 with a greatly expanded edition due for publication later this year. And he has programmed and written notes on the Victor Herbert album released in the American Musical Theater series of the Smithsonian Institution some years ago. Today, Professor Debus will speak to us on the English music hall performer and American big-time vaudeville, Alan G. Debus. And we will keep our fingers crossed on the technology this afternoon as well.
Is that light all right?
That's fine. I think I'll move. Well,
I don't want this tape down now.
Okay, that's all right. Now, because of the limitations of time, I won't be playing records in their entirety, with one exception, and that will be the record of George Lashwood. The records have been taped by Rich Marco, who is sitting down there in charge of the mechanics of it all. I'm thankful to him for taping these for me for this afternoon's presentation. Now, I should mention also later, not yet. The paper that I'm giving is a truncated version of one that is scheduled to appear in the summer issue of the English periodical Theatre File. Although there has been a long tradition of English and American performers playing in each other's countries, we will be concerned here this afternoon solely with American vaudeville and a limited number of English headliners who were favorites in the United States. The life of vaudeville was shorter than that of English music hall. It was the predominant form of popular entertainment for only about 40 years, say from 1885 to about 1925. Then radio and a little later sound films brought a very rapid decline of this form of entertainment. The acme of vaudeville was surely the first two decades of the 20th century. These years saw the development of a number of theater circuits: Keith Orpheum, Sun, Pantages, Sullivan Considine, many others. Associations of vaudeville theaters stretched from coast to coast, and these permitted specialty acts of all kinds to work for long periods of time as they made their way from one theater to the next in the chain. The distances could be daunting to even the hardiest performer. During the season of 1924-25, for instance, Bert Lahr traveled some 10,000 miles. The lights, I think, and the first slide. The Palace Theater at Broadway and 47th Street in New York City was the key vaudeville house in America, opened in 1913, still there. Little less important was Oscar Hammerstein's Victoria Theater of Varieties at 42nd Street and 7th Avenue. Here we have a program for the week of September 11th, 1911. Probably those of you in back won't be able to see the small print. But this indicates the makeup of a first-rank vaudeville show. There were comedy acts, singers of popular songs, novelty acts, a major star, Lottie Gilson, called The Little Magnet, a boxing kangaroo, and finally a comedy skit, The Newlyweds, before putting on the so-called dumb acts, those cyclists and jugglers who could be enjoyed in spite of the noise of an audience now beginning to leave the theater. There's little doubt that American artists were among the most popular variety stars to tour the American circuits. And yet to be a hit in another country was not always assured by one's star status at home. Although Mari Lloyd was the queen of English variety, her material seemed too suggestive for American audiences, and her sister Alice far outshined her in American vaudeville and revues. The same could happen to Americans in England. Nora Bays and her husband Jack Norworth were among the most popular American married couples on stage. But in the USA, Nora clearly took top billing. After their divorce in 1913, they both tried England in single acts. Nora did not do well, but Jack was so well received by English audiences that he did not return to New York until 1917. The easy interchange of material may best be seen in the popularity of the same music on both sides of the Atlantic. If English ballads and comic songs were utilized in American vaudeville, ragtime was quickly adopted throughout the British Isles. In this regard, an artist of special interest is Bert Shepherd, who toured a variety of American minstrel companies from the mid-70s through the 90s. By this time, the minstrel show was in decline, and he turned to vaudeville. He also accepted an offer to appear in England, and they found that his style was appreciated there as well as at home. In England, he recorded cylinders and discs of the latest American songs, and on his return home, he recorded English material for the Victor Talking Machine Company. Although Dan Leno never appeared in the United States, turn-of-the-century phonograph owners in America could listen to Bert Shepherd recite Leno's specialties, while in England, phonograph owners could listen to his cylinders of Bert Williams' latest coon songs. The enthusiasm in America for first-rank English entertainers may be seen as early as the mid-90s with the visits of Albert Chevalier. A New York newspaper clipping dated March 15, 1895 headlines the fact that Chevalier is on his way. The great singing coster who has sent England wild soon to be here. And it goes on. The most talked of man and the best paid artist in the English theatrical world today is Albert Chevalier, the only legitimate exponent of coster art. He holds a position absolutely unique without a rival, and he makes more money in a week than Henry Irving ever dreamed of. And now he is coming to America at a salary greater than was ever paid any male performer excepting Jean Dereske. A year later, Chevalier was back in New York, an event that merited his being placed on the cover of the New York Dramatic News for the weekly edition of April 11th, seen here. A long newspaper article compared the humor and pathos of his songs with the art of Charles Dickens. He was presenting five of his songs at the time, The Future Mrs. Hawkins, Our Little Nipper, Our Court Ball, Watcher or Noctum in the Old Kent Road, and then to quote, his most artistic conception, My Old Dutch, the universal and familiar endearment for a wife. It deserves to be placed in the best gallery of old men's stage portraits, and in it, affection and pathos are shown at their highest. He was to return to America a number of times before his death in 1923, appearing even in a silent film based on My Old Dutch in 1915. And here we have a 1911 recording he made for HMV, part of it.
I got a pen, a regular pen. Be a good old girl, and I'll tell you all about her. It's many years since I've been met, there was then a thrill at the jet. It was an hour, but she don't fret. Not my old girl. We've been together now for 40 years, and it don't seem a day too much more than I. A lady living in the land as I was for me dear old Dutch. And all that I, a lady living in the land as I was for me dear old Dutch.
Between 1907 and 1911, a new group of English male performers followed in Chevalier's footsteps. Harry Lauder, Albert Whelan, Wilkie Bard, and George Lashwood all succeeded with American audiences, but not all to the same degree. Hired at over $3,000 a week, Wilkie Bard opened in New York, first at Hammerstein's Victoria. His act failed, but he was able to rework it successfully for an American audience. He experienced the same problem at the New York Palace in 1919, but once again he was able to salvage his act. Albert Whelan, and here I have a newspaper clipping I got out of an English newspaper back in 1960. He was about 85 at the time, starting out a new act after having a leg amputated. Albert Whelan became known in American vaudeville for the specialty The Three Trees, a number which had originally been introduced in New York in the very successful musical The Spring Maid by Tom McNaughton, who was the husband of Alice Lloyd, this in 1910. Whelan seemed promising enough to the Columbia Phonograph Company of New York to be signed to make several recordings, among them a 12-inch version of the music hall classic, I Can Say Truly Rural. This is the American recording of 1910.
I've just come home from the boys. We've had some fun, and I might as well say that I always have fun with the boys. They told me to call them when I got home, and if the wife wanted a fight, to open the window and shout truly rural, and then they would know I'm all right. We've had a few words. We do that every day. But still, I'm delighted to say I can say, I can say anything. Now, look here. This is what I want to know. Is anyone here thinks they can sing this song? Anyone can sing truly rural? Now, any lady or gentleman will do. I could like to try, sir. All right, my boy. Do you think you know this song? Yes, I know the song. Oh, you do? All right. All right. Now, if you sing this nicely, you get a present of a great big ring. A big ring, mind. Whoever sings is the best. Now, go ahead. But I don't want the band. You don't want the band. Makes you nervous, does it? All right, my boy. No band. You ready? La, la, ta, 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 ta. Now go ahead.
I can say truly rural, truly rural, truly rural. It's past midnight, but I'm all right, because I can sing truly rural.
Wait, whoa, 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 my boy. There's no truly rural business. Truly rural, it's easy enough. I'll tell you what, one side, please. Now then. Everybody, I want all the ladies and gentlemen to sing this song, please. And the one who sings it the best gets the prize of a nice, big, large ring, remember? Now then, one, two,
five.
Splendid. Very good indeed. Now then, sir, you win the prize. You little boy over there with the boots on. Here's your ring that I promised you.
Also signed by Columbia was George Lashwood, who recorded in America a series of songs he was well known for in England, CCC in the twilight, my latchkey, there's another fellow looks like me, and send for a policeman. This, by the way, is a picture of Lashwood, a photograph in front of the American Music Hall in Chicago in 1911. In its weekly review of new vaudeville acts, the New York Dramatic Mirror, this is the December 18th, 1909 issue, noted that, and this is a fairly long quotation, and I've edited this down somewhat. At the Plaza Music Hall last week, where he made his American debut, he won instant recognition. Lashwood had been announced, and so loudly and widely, that one began to think, to sort of anticipate a deep disappointment. Such is so often the case. Three big causes enter into the successful makeup of Mr. Lashwood. In the first place, he has a remarkably exuberant and appealing personality, to say nothing of stage confidence, real ability, and good looks. In the second, he dresses and stages his act in a most admirable fashion. And in the third, which might well come first, he sings a number of songs that are tuneful, witty, and appealing, some a bit risque, but not vulgar. Seldom, even recognizing the song hits of Miss Alice Lloyd and Harry Lauder, has a European come to our shores with such rattling good material. And on Thursday night, the audience commenced humming the choruses of most of his songs after a first rendition. Mr. Lashwood opened with a comic song, mildly risque in one verse, entitled It's Another Fellow Looks Like Me, appearing in evening garb of the latest London mode. Then a special set showing the deck of a Channel steamer with a sea drop in the background was used. The comedian appeared in white flannels and straw hat and sang a most amusing song, CCC, Why Are You So Angry With Me, calling with for much of the business relative to certain well-defined consequences of ocean travel. In the twilight caught the fancy of the audience, and barring a few lines which might be taken suggestively, it is a song that should become exceedingly popular. He wore an immaculate brown frock suit with high silk hat and proved him his Beau Brummel title. The audience called for more until Mr. Lashwood obliged with what proved to be his best number, My Latch Key. He worked in a spot during this rendition and again wore evening clothes. The number was partly recitative and had to do with the days of bachelorhood, which the singer was about to cast aside in favor of matrimony, and hence his friendly latchkey and he are forced to part. At its close, Mr. Lashwood was called out for many bows, and the audience did not begin to subside until the cards for the next act were placed and the act had fairly gotten underway. A word regarding the costume changes of the artist are due here, for seldom, if ever, has a player been seen who makes such rapid changes and who appears each time in such faultless attire. Both Americans and Europeans can learn a big lesson by watching him, not for this alone, but for other reasons that make him a vaudeville star worthy of the name. And this is the American recording of In the Twilight.
The twilight, and the hour of the day for which most of them pray is the twilight. There's a boy at the corner of him very sweet, and the girl as she meets him is looking so neat. Never one thinks of the size of a heartbeat in the twilight. Oh, the twilight, night. They all go out for a walk, walk, walk. A nice little spoon and a talk, talk, talk. That's the time that they long for. Just before the night, with your head in the whirl and a lovely fat girl in the twilight. This world you will find, they are deaf, dumb, and blind in the twilight. And 4 hours they'll remain, though it's pouring with rain, in the twilight. They'll make for a corner in one of the parks, so shady that no one's a present remark. The birds up above them can tell of them lost in the twilight. In the twilight. I say, have ever you been round Central Park of a Sunday evening? That's the place to catch 'em. There they sit side by each. His arm round there, you know, and her arm round there, and yum, 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 yum. Yes, before the night, with her head on his breast, she hopes for the best in the twilight.
And yet the successes of Bard, Whelan, and Lashwood were short-lived. These performers were infrequent visitors to America, and while they loom large in histories of the English music hall, they are largely forgotten in the United States. How different this is in comparison with Harry Lauder. Lauder began performing at the age of 12, and only after years of playing small theaters in Scotland and the provincial towns of England did he finally secure an engagement in London in 1900. He was an instant success, and when an opportunity came to appear in the United States in 1907, he took it. From his first appearance in New York, it was the beginning of a long love affair between Lauder and the American public. His last tour was in 1934, his 25th. So loyal were his fans that in 1911, his audience remained at the Manhattan Opera House until a quarter of one in the morning when his ship was delayed by fog. And during the First World War, there were few American artists who put more effort into the sale of Liberty Bonds than did Lauder. American recording companies took advantage of the discs and cylinders Lauder had made for their sister companies headquartered in London. Pathé released We Parted on the Shore, recorded originally in England, while Edison began releasing Lauder cylinders in March 1908. It was in 1908 also that the Victor Talking Machine Company began raiding the HMV masters for Lauder material. The first releases were offered on the cheap black label series, but when he began to make new recordings for them in New York in 1909, these were slated for the new higher-priced purple label series reserved for vaudeville headliners and classical artists who were judged not to merit Red Seal recognition. Indeed, Lauder records were chosen to lead off both the 10-inch and the 12-inch purple label series. New Victor Records for January 1912 introduced the new American recordings of The Picnic, Roaming in the Gloaming, A Wee Doc and Doris, and Breakfast in Bed on Sunday Morning, with the notice that the comedian interrupts a sensational tour to sing for the victor. Four new records by the greatest of entertainers. The most remarkable 6 weeks tour ever made by an entertainer has just been completed by Harry Lauder, beginning with a week in New York at the Manhattan Opera House, where he played 12 performances to nearly 40,000 people. The comedian visited the large cities of the East and Middle West, in most cases playing only 1 or 2 days in each city, and sailed for England after breaking all records for large receipts. It is estimated that Lauder played to more than $80,000 in the 6 weeks' time. The most important feature of the tour, however, was the recording of all his new songs for the victor, as by means of these he will sing to a vastly larger audience, the great victor public, which can hear the Scotch entertainer whenever the fancy pleases. In fact, this advertising blurb was not far from the mark, since I do believe that these four records were among the most popular to be issued by Victor before the advent of electrical recording. Among the women performers, Americans loved the male impersonators no less than the English. Perhaps the greatest of these was Vesta Tilly, who first appeared in New York at Tony Pastor's Music Hall in 1894. Attired in top hat, white tie, and tail, she most commonly played the part of a young dandy, a young tough. But she also frequently worked in uniform for numbers such as The Army of Today's All Right, a favorite during the First World War. Although Tilly never recorded in the United States, she had made a series of cylinders in London for Edison in 1907. And during her American tour of 1909, 10 of these were released in England in a special announcement to dealers assuring them that these records would, and I quote again, these records would receive the immediate and merited approval of phonograph owners the country over. Miss Tilly's inimitable and charming art has delighted the audiences in the larger cities where she has appeared, and her phonograph success will follow as a matter of course. The many who have seen her dainty, fascinating manner and heard the peculiar sweetness of her voice will at once recognize the songs in which she has made such an unprecedented success. Those to whom her work is new will probably join her friends in proclaiming her an artist of most remarkable ability. The fact that Miss Tilly is again playing important vaudeville engagements in this country makes the issuance of these 10 records particularly timely. Now, what I have on tape is a jumbo record she made in England, Introduce Me to the Lady, and the part that I have is the verse in which, slightly inebriated, she comes in with a friend and sees in the hall a statue of the Venus de Milo, and then she says, "Introduce me to the lady."
One night moonlight, old Simpson from the club was walking home at straight as I am now. Front door, 4-4, the wrong one got inside. And in the hall, a statue there of Venus here tied. He looked at it and said, "You saucy cat." Then murmured as he tripped across the mat, "Introduce me to the lady, introduce me to the girl. I don't care what color she may be, dark or fair. Just say to me, introduce me to the lady, for your hair has got no curl.
Vesta Tilly's closest rival may well have been Hetty King, who made very few recordings, but who is well remembered because she was still performing in her late 80s, up to about 15 years ago. Like so many of the best-known variety artists, Hetty King specialized in character songs, changing costumes for her various numbers. She was most famous in sailor's togs, singing Ship Ahoy, All the Nice Girls Love a Sailor. But she was just as comfortable in formal evening attire as Vesta Tilly. I recall her well on BBC television about 25 years ago, singing a rollicking music hall number dressed in tails and smoking a cigar. She was truly a marvelous performer, and that is just what the New York audiences thought when she appeared in 1909. Her act was described in the New York Dramatic Mirror for December 25th, 1909. And they say, following the appearances of Vesta Tilly last season, Hetty King's appearance here this year is given an added interest, although the latter may be said to work at a slight disadvantage owing to the undoubted popularity of Miss Tilly with American audiences. And though they are both male impersonators, each has a different method and each assumes characters that are somewhat unlike those used by the other. Hence, comparisons are hardly fair. Miss King dresses her parts in quite as dapper a manner as does Miss Tilly, and her appearances as the typical London Beau Brummel are most becoming to her, and she wears her clothes remarkably well. Her first character impersonation was that of a seaside youth who appeared in a natty blue sack suit, single-breasted coat, straw hat with black band, patent leather shoes with white tops and black buttons, black four-in-hand tie, and high collar. The accompanying song, Beside the Seaside, was quite tuneful, and on the whole, the number was pleasing. This was followed by Miss King's appearance as a young naval officer, for which character she wore a dark blue naval officer's uniform. Next, she was seen as a young chap in morning walking suit consisting of a black cutaway, one-button coat, top hat, drab waistcoat with white facings, gray four-in-hand tie, patent leather shoes with drab tops, gray suede gloves, violet boutonniere monocle, and walking stick. I'll skip some of the other songs she did, and the article closes. An encore was called for on Wednesday night, and the artist responded with an old favorite of hers, Going Away, in which song she impersonates the character of a British sailor who is about to start forth on a sea voyage. The dance, though not typical of the sea, was dainty and pretty to watch, and the audience seemed to forget that it might as well have been done with skirts as in sailor's trousers. The act ran 32 minutes, including the encore number, a long time for the usual vaudeville offering, but not for Miss King.
I've been a bit of a devil again, a sort of a belly, you know. That is why I'm given the slip to warn the girls and so on. I've packed of all my little bits of things and odds and ends. I've said goodbye to Mother, Dad, and all my dear old friends. I'll miss the dear old homestead, and I'll miss my pals too. But I want a mystery girls, and so I'm going to put
from an English twin recording. Alice Lloyd and Vesta Victoria were the other two English women who attained superstardom in American vaudeville. Although Mari Lloyd, Alice's sister, had appeared at Coster and Biles Music Hall in New York as early as 1897, Her style and her material were too suggestive for the family audiences then being courted by theater managers. Mari returned to the United States a number of times, but she never achieved great popularity. Alice, on the other hand, became a star almost immediately, although she was far less popular in England than her sister. Alice appeared in New York first in February 1907, where the audience welcomed her so enthusiastically that she was made the headliner for the second week. This appearance led to a Victor recording contract, and in May and June of that year, she recorded five of the songs she was using in her act: Young Men Lodgers, May, 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 The Tale of the Clothesline or Stockings on the Line, Never Introduce Your Bloke to Your Lady Friend, and her most popular number, You Splash Me and I'll Splash You. Alice Lloyd returned for American tours almost annually until the war, and in a readers' contest sponsored by Variety in 1911 for the ideal vaudeville bill, Alice Lloyd and Harry Lauder were the two British performers among the nine acts chosen. In 1912, Alice Lloyd entered musical comedy, taking over the part originally played by Nora Bayes in Little Miss Fix-It. And she was to return to America periodically over the next decade until her final tour in 1927-28. Like Alice Lloyd, Vesta Victoria was a longtime favorite with American vaudeville patrons. Her first engagement in the United States was as early as 1893, when she sang one of her most enduring song hits, Daddy Wouldn't Buy Me a Bow Wow, an early double entendre song. She was back again several times in the mid and late 90s, and then there was an eight-year lapse before her return in 1906. From that time until the war, she was almost an annual visitor to New York and the vaudeville circuits. In 1907, she signed a contract with the Victor Talking Machine Company, and she recorded 12 of her current hits, which she did in three studio sessions. When Sime Silverman reviewed her act for Variety that year, he called her the magnetic, pretty, buxom character actress, the idol of the New York public, unexcelled and impossible of imitation. And this is her Victor recording of Man, Man, Man.
With a rose for another girl stuck in his head. Girls, to be happy, their games you must stop and keep them down there with your thumb on the top. Everyone selfish and mean as can be. They collar the blessed milk out of your tea. Girls, you're thinking of the men. If you knew what I know about men, you'd look before you leave. Men are all right when they're fast asleep. Oh, I've had some, so I ought to know. If you can't see through them, I can. It's something to put your cold feet on at night. That's a man, man, man.
Vesta Victoria retired from the stage after the First World War, but returned to variety several times after that. Most of her post-war performances were in England, but she had a successful engagement headlining at the Palace in New York in 1927. There is little doubt that English and Scottish performers were extremely popular in American variety. And here again, you won't be able to see this. This is the Auditorium Theater in Chicago, still a show place. It was opened by President Benjamin Harrison in 1889. But perhaps you'll be able to see at the end of the first column, Hetty King is here now, and coming soon is Vesta Victoria. I think we can have the lights on any time now. There's little doubt that English and Scottish performers were popular, as I say. However, although they surely drew large crowds to the theaters, in general, the sale of their records did not reflect their personal popularity. When Victor introduced double-faced recordings in 1908, the most popular releases were transferred to the new form. Of the then recently recorded selections by Alice Lloyd and Vesta Victoria, only one title was carried over, Alice Lloyd's You Splash Me and I'll Splash You. The remaining single-sided records were dropped rapidly from the catalog. No records by Hetty King or Wilkie Bard were issued in the United States, and the Lashwood and Whelan records were only available for a short period. And if Edison made much of the release of the Vesta Tilly cylinders, they too were only available for a few years in a special English series. The one real exception to this rule was Harry Lauder, whose enormous popularity on stage was indeed matched by his popularity with owners of phonographs. Some of his songs sold in great quantities, and when the electrical recording process replaced the old acoustic method in 1925, Lauder was called back to the studio to re-record his best numbers. Edison used the cylinder matrices he had made in London, but they were barred from recording discs for their new diamond discs due to Lauder's Victor contract, which allowed him to make discs only for them. In their search for a cover artist for the Lauder material, Edison, Columbia, Emerson, and Brunswick turned to imitators such as Glenn Ellison, Sandy Shaw, Evan Davies, and Sandy McFarlane. American recording companies also searched English master vaults in the hope that they might find some other artist who might rival the sale of the Victor Lauder releases. Victor offered the public Ada Reeves' Father's Little Man and Foolish Questions, while Columbia turned to Cyril Maude's dramatic recitations, Whit Cunliffe's I Had a Divil of a Time Last Night, Harry Champion's Little Bit of Cucumber, and Will Fife's I Belong to Glasgow. None of these records sold very well, although Columbia did hit pay dirt with a chance issuance of Joe Heyman's Cohen on the Telephone. One other music hall artist whose records had a fairly large sale in the United States was Billy Williams, the man in the velvet suit. Williams never performed in America, but his records were first offered here in 1911 and 1912 by Edison and Columbia. Even Pathé included Billy Williams in its catalogs until about 1920. And yet even these sales could only be judged a minor success compared to the phenomenon of Harry Lauder. In short, the American public was exposed to English music hall headliners throughout the glory years of American vaudeville. From the early appearances of Vesta Victoria, Albert Chevalier, and others in the 90s, through the declining years of this form of entertainment in the late 20s. It may be that some of our stereotypes of the tight-fisted Scot derive from the characteristic portrayals of Harry Lauder, while our view of the English upper crust may still be colored by long-gone performances of Vesta Tilly and Hetty King. At the least, these performers paved the way for the more sophisticated performers of the post-World War I period, such as Noel Coward, Gertrude Lawrence, and Jack Buchanan, who were to be so well received in New York and throughout the English-speaking world. Thank you.